Com. Puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblosinfronteras@gmail.com.
El hombre sigue la tarde, lleva el triunfo entre sus manos, lleva el triunfo entre sus manos, el hombre sigue la tarde.
Seguimos con noticias de México. La empresa Grupo México rechazó que su minera subsidiaria Buenavista del Cobre sea responsable del derrame de 40.000 metros cúbicos de sustancias tóxicas al río Bacanuchi, afluente del río Sonora. Grupo México rechazó la denuncia penal presentada por la Procuraduría Federal de Protección al Ambiente. El derrame ha afectado a más de 30.000 personas en el estado de Sonora. El sindicato de mineros ha pedido al gobierno que se le revoquen las concesiones a Grupo México, liderado por Germán Larrea, uno de los hombres más ricos del mundo. En información relacionada, en Guanajuato, México, demandan a una empresa porque denuncian sus vertidos químicos causan cáncer a comunidades cercanas. Eduardo Méndez con el informe.
El grupo de activistas Fuerte de Acción Ciudadana demandará a la empresa Química Central por daños contra la salud debido a que los habitantes de varias comunidades vecinas tienen cáncer. Aseguran que es por culpa del cromo hexavalente que produce esta empresa. Este problema tiene más de 30 años en las comunidades cercanas a Química Central ubicadas por San Francisco del Rincón y Purísima en Guanajuato. Estos líquidos que ha dejado la empresa Química Central se componen de cromo hexavalente, que es muy peligroso. Su nombre real es cromo 6. Es el residuo que deja el proceso de fabricación de la empresa para producir sales de cromo muy usadas en la curtiduría de pieles. El cromo 6 tiene un nivel tóxico muy alto. Si uno está cerca de ese líquido durante mucho tiempo, puede producir cáncer. Hasta este momento, la Secretaría de Salud de Guanajuato asegura que los desechos no han aumentado los casos de cáncer en la zona. Sin embargo, en rueda de prensa, los abogados que representan a los habitantes que aseguran haber sido afectados por Química Central, Maximiliano Segura y Gerardo Gutiérrez Romero, dijeron que van a llevar el caso a la Cámara de Diputados Federal para exigir que se indemnice a las personas de comunidades como Buenavista. Hasta el momento son 12 casos de gente con cáncer, aunque dijeron que esta cantidad puede aumentar. Desde nuestra radio en Huayacocotla, Veracruz, con información de Revolución 3.0, Eduardo Méndez Salas.
La presidenta de Argentina anunció un proyecto de ley para pagar a sus acreedores que aceptaron reestructurar la deuda soberana. Pepe Frutos informa.
La presidenta Cristina Fernández anunció por cadena nacional el envío de un proyecto de ley al Congreso Nacional para cambiar el lugar de pago que el país viene haciendo con la mayoría de los bonistas que tienen títulos de la deuda argentina. El 92% de los bonistas que arregló un pago con nuestro país y que vienen teniendo bloqueados esos cobros por decisión del juez Tomás Griesa, que tomó esta medida por pedido de apenas el 1% de los bonistas, los denominados fondos buitres. Así lo anunciaba la presidenta Cristina Fernández ayer por la cadena nacional de radio y televisión.
Por eso hemos decidido enviar una ley al Congreso Nacional, ley del pago soberano local de la deuda externa de la República Argentina. Se autoriza al Ministerio de Economía y Finanzas Públicas adoptar las medidas necesarias para remover al Banco de Nueva York, Mellon, como agente fiduciario y a designar en su reemplazo a Nación Fideicomisos Sociedad Anónima. Todo ello sin perjuicio del derecho que asiste a los tenedores de designar un nuevo agente fiduciario que garantice el canal de cobro de los servicios correspondientes a los títulos reestructurados.
Y con este proyecto de ley que anunció la presidenta Cristina Fernández, se cambiará el agente de pago con el 92% de los bonistas, que dejará de ser el Banco de Nueva York Mellon, donde están bloqueados los fondos del último pago que hizo el país, y pasará a hacerlo un fideicomiso del Banco de la Nación Argentina. Los pagos se van a depositar de ahora en más en una cuenta especial del Banco Central. Claro, Esto si el Congreso Nacional, donde el oficialismo tiene mayoría tanto en el Senado como en la Cámara de Diputados, logra transformar en ley este proyecto anunciado ayer por la presidenta Cristina Fernández.
Legisladores de Costa Rica le negaron el recinto parlamentario al presidente del país para que presente su informe por los primeros 100 días de trabajo. Los detalles con Sonia Jiménez. Mientras en el estado mexicano de Guanajuato acusan a una empresa porque dicen viene causando cáncer a las mujeres. Eduardo Méndez con el informe.
El presidente Luis Guillermo Solís presentará su informe de 100 días de gestión el próximo jueves 28 de agosto a las 7 de la noche en el Teatro Melico Salazar. La decisión la tomó luego de la negativa de los diputados de recibirlo esta semana en el seno de la Asamblea Legislativa. El mandatario adujo que ante la imposibilidad de llevar su informe al Congreso, ahora se lo llevará a la gente, pues también lo dará en las comunidades que así se lo pidan, e imprimirá una versión más pequeña para entregarla entre la población. Al acto oficial, invitará a los diputados e irá acompañado de su gabinete, viceministros y presidentes ejecutivos de instituciones autónomas. El informe estará compuesto por tres partes: el estado de cómo recibió la nación, las acciones que realizó durante los primeros tres meses de mandato para corregir esa situación y, por último, cuál es el rumbo de su gobierno en el corto plazo, ya que las acciones a largo plazo las dará a conocer en noviembre, cuando presente el Plan Nacional de Desarrollo. Solís aseveró que la actividad durará entre 2 y 3 horas, pues después de leer el documento, se someterá a preguntas de diferentes sectores productivos, a quienes también invitará. El presidente culpabilizó al Partido Liberación Nacional de la negativa hacia su plan de presentar el informe en el Congreso. A su juicio, los verdiblancos tienen temor del contenido del mismo, tomando en cuenta que los últimos dos gobiernos han sido liberacionistas. Desde Radio Santa Clara y les informó Sonia Jiménez.
El gobierno venezolano impulsa un proyecto de ley para ayudar a estudiantes graduados a encontrar un empleo. Teófilo Griffin con el reporte.
La Ley para el Empleo Juvenil busca abrir oportunidad al emprendimiento e innovación en un país que atraviesa un bono demográfico. La mayoría de su población se encuentra entre los 15 y 30 años, una edad económicamente activa. Aquí los jóvenes esperan de la nueva ley que no sea limitante al salir de la universidad el no tener experiencia laboral para optar al empleo. Una de las solicitudes más comunes en Venezuela por empresas y organismos gubernamentales.
Con esta nueva ley nosotros buscamos y pretendemos insertar a la juventud venezolana en el desarrollo productivo del país.
Pero el proyecto de ley de empleo juvenil para el emprendimiento productivo no solamente atendería el desempleo en jóvenes, también busca garantizar que tengan un trabajo no dependiente, es decir, que se les brinde oportunidades en su formación técnica e incluso acceder a créditos de instituciones financieras para desarrollar sus propios proyectos que permitan diversificar la economía venezolana.
Nosotros creemos que nuestros jóvenes pueden ser impulsores bien significativos de proyectos, de iniciativas sobre la base del conocimiento que tienen, de los proyectos de investigación que hacen durante su formación como profesionales.
Más de 600 asambleas se realizaron por todo el país, en instituciones universitarias públicas y privadas, y las comunidades también participaron en el diseño del instrumento legal que por primera vez le permitiría a la juventud protagonizar el desarrollo de su país.
Esta ley viene a atender eso, pues, a esa juventud que también quiere tener su propia empresa, que también quiere desarrollarse, que también quiere producir.
Venezuela registra la segunda matrícula universitaria más alta de América Latina y la quinta en el mundo. En esta nación buscan aprovechar esa formación para impulsar las fuerzas productivas. La juventud espera que el proyecto de ley sea aprobado por el propio presidente de la República, Nicolás Maduro, vía habilitante. Teófilo Griffin, Telesur, Caracas, Venezuela.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a la multiestatal Telesur, al diario La Jornada, a la Asociación Latinoamericana de Educación Radiofónica, a Farco de Argentina y a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, Se despide Norma Martínez.
Te invitamos a que te unas a nuestras redes sociales por Twitter en info-pacífica o por Facebook bajo el nombre de nuestro productor Fernando Velázquez e Informativo Pacífica. Escucha el noticiero cada día de lunes a viernes en Pueblos Sin Fronteras, wordpress.com.
This is Ian from Fugazi, and this is Radio Free Santa Cruz. Music should be free, and so should radio.
Tune in at 7 p.m. for The Great Leap Forward. This is a really good interview. You really, this guy, he is.
Cut! Take two!
Tune in on The Great Leap Forward. We have a radio station on Free Radio Santa Cruz. What's the matter with me? I'm losing something. What is it? Oh, yeah, my mind. On The Great Leap Forward at 7 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM. It's so complicated, this whole thing. I don't know if I can take it much longer. There's nothing better on free radio than The Great Leap Forward. You're going to want to gather around the radio at 7 p.m. Wednesday. Every Wednesday. If you miss one, you could perish. Yes, your life could become nothing at all. Bob's making me do this. If anyone can hear this, please come help me. He's keeping me captive. Where are the refreshments anyway? I thought there'd be chocolate-covered strawberries.
After you're done, you get your treat. Get to work. I can't work like this!
And that was in the old days of Free Radio Santa Cruz. John Malkin and Skidmark Bob batting it back and forth. Now we're in the new leaner, meaner, fatter, slacker days of Free Radio. Coming up next is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the August 21st, 2014 show. Going to be covering the Board of Stupid Vipers meeting. That's the supervisors, for those who prefer to use their proper title, as well as a report on the Santa Cruz 11 hearing on the same day. Actually, no, it was yesterday. Wednesday there was a hearing, and an update on the fate of Lighthouse Linda LeMaster, a survivor and supporter of Peace Camp 2010. Stay tuned.
Not only a problem, for only one reason that president raises the question, who owns a land? The homeless, our problem, for only one reason, our president raises the question, who owns a land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land?
my presence, which is a question, who owns the land? The homeless, our problem, for only one reason, your presence, which is a question, who owns the land? Ecocide, genocide, where is vote? Ecocide, genocide, where is vote? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is
home?
And welcome to Bathurst Spears Broadsides, and I'm Robert Norris, and I know who you are, but you can tell me by calling in, because we do have a call-in line. We might even have two. Yeah, amazing. We actually have two call-in lines today. One is at 427-3772, 427-FRSC. We are indeed Freak Radio Santa Cruz, so easy to remember, easy to dial, easy to punch in, 427-3772. Call if you have any thoughts, questions, updates, whatever. We can talk it over, or at least you can get your voice out and I can rattle back at you. The other number is 469-3119, 469-3119, and that's in case you don't catch me on the 427 line because I'm sleeping or somebody is on the line. Looks like both lines are available, though, so if you've got updates, particularly breaking news, very interested. Or if I'm not interested, I should be, and maybe you can interest us. So I'll be with you until 8 o'clock, at which point I don't know if Uncle Dennis is back with From the Cream to the Dregs. If he's not, we will dust off another one of those ancient shows, which he has left. Uncle Dennis has never seen fit to actually record a recent show, anything newer than 5 years old. Maybe exaggerating here, but it's pretty old. But, you know, the shows are, it's a music show pretty much, although Uncle Dennis does do Earth First Updates, which are interesting and educational, those that I've heard. I encourage you to hang in there and check them out. I have been carrying my trusty, if limited, tape recorder around with me in the last few days. It's been a kind of a busy scene over the weekend. HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, voted to try to cover events that were happening over the weekend with some flyering. I created a flyer, which you can find on Santa Cruz Indie Media, and that flyer talks about the issues that, well, some of which are nearest and dearest to the hearts of the Hufsters. The harassment of homeless people outside, the seizure of their property, which is also apparently coming up at an ACLU meeting on Monday of the Board of Directors, according to Vice Chair Steve Plaich. He advised me about this in an email today that there will be, he will be bringing up as an information item on the agenda, a concern that the homeless seem to be losing their property, which may not only be criminal, but also life-threatening, not to mention enraging, and also a form of, abusive behavior by authority that has become institutionalized over the years, particularly in the silence of the local ACLU and other pseudo-progressive groups. And Plaich, to his credit, albeit 3 years late, is bringing this issue up at the ACLU meeting as a informational item. That means that members of the public might want to go to this meeting. It's from 7 to 9 at the Loudon-Nelson Center on Monday. 7 to 9, Loudon-Nelson Center on Monday. There's actually another candidate forum on Tuesday coming up, too, and I'll be giving you times and places for that as soon as I can dig them out of my records here. A lot of things happened this weekend in terms of events that I was either passing out flyers at or giving people flyers that they could pass out at. The one event that I did not get to was the Laney Sherman event. It was billed as a civil liberties event at the house of attorney Ben Rice, who I saw briefly in the courtroom as he passed by in his usual quick, haven't got much time to talk to you approach, but Rice has been a supporter of the Santa Cruz 11. Of course, he was like paid to represent one of them, Bradley Stewart Allen, and successfully represented him. He, as well as seven others, were dropped from this bizarre prosecution of 11 people who were essentially singled out by authorities to demonize the Santa Cruz, the Occupy movement that blossomed briefly in the fall of 2011. And a splinter group took over the vacant Wells Fargo-leased 75 River Street Bank building. Foreclosure fraud, of course, was a notorious and still is a notorious reality and characteristic of the Wells Fargo mega giant. I think there was a big settlement today by Bank of America, which really wasn't so big considering the tax breaks it's likely to get. It was like $17, $18 billion settlement, but much of it may be written off by B of A, and how much it will actually get to those whose homes were lost, foreclosed on, or who are on the edge of losing their homes is not clear to me at all, and hasn't been made clear in the news stories I've read in the local papers. Not that that would necessarily happen anyway. But in any case, there were people concerned about this bankster fraud, concerned about vacant buildings in winter when homeless people were freezing, concerned about the need for a community center. So this group presumptuously took over a vacant bank building, held it for 3 days without any violence, although with a certain amount of determination and rage and, you know, masks and stuff like that. And there was some damage done to the inside of the property. Some what they called vandalism. Some furniture was broken. I guess there were some barricades made at some point. And there was some graffiti. And because they cut off the water, people began crapping in different places as they occupied the building. Or after they had a crap room, I think, as I understand it. I'm not sure. Someday, you know, when this is all behind us, we can get some honest, completely transparent reporting on this. But the problem is reporters were also, I for one, for instance, hauled into court two or three months later in February of 2012 and charged with felonies and misdemeanors for even just being in the building. There's been no evidence presented that any of the homeless people or the non-homeless people who took over the bank, most of those charged were not homeless, committed any vandalism. But the fact is that because they were in the bank and vandalism happened, they were charged with it, which, of course, is, to me, bullshit and obviously an excuse for the prosecution to terrorize the community and, exalt the rights of the Wells Fargo Bank above the rights of peaceful protest. And that continues to stick in my craw and continues to chill protest in Santa Cruz and has for the last 3 years. And usually people will start saying, well, what about private property? They're going to take over my home, you know, and that sort of thing. And the answer, of course, is it's Wells Fargo that's going to take over your home. It's Bank of America that's going to take over your home. It is foreclosure activities that are going to take over your home, not protesters protesting those institutions and trying to stop that from happening. But this has all been drowned in a reactionary yowl from the usual suspects. If you go to the Santa Cruz Urinal, Sentinel is what they call themselves, the daily newspaper, and you see and you read online, you can catch their drift, or it's sort of a Take Back Santa Cruz type mentality, but it's always been around town. It predates that organization. So the Santa Cruz 11 is a case that's still going on. Four people are still being charged with essentially, I think it's a felony vandalism and misdemeanor trespass. And you can get 4 years in prison for all that. And they are, you're going to hear one of the attorneys shortly talk about that. She showed up in court. Her name is Alexis Briggs on behalf of one of her clients, Cameron Lorando, one of the final four, to argue that Bob Lee, the prosecutor boss, the main DA in Santa Cruz, did not reveal that he had gotten a $34,000 loan from Wells Fargo on his campaign, and that for election campaign in 2010, and 2,000 of it
he had paid it back, but several months later, but there had been no interest charged on the loan. Now, was this special procedure by Wells Fargo to be nice to Bob Lee, not necessarily in hopes of getting preferential treatment, but maybe because they like his political views, they like him better than the other people running. I don't remember who was running in 2010 against him. Nobody ran this time when he ran this spring for re-election for district attorney. And so the issue is, did Wells Fargo, did Bob Lee commit an impropriety that requires recusing him from the case entirely by not revealing his connections, Wells Fargo's connections with him and his connections with Wells Fargo in terms of this loan and any other loans that may have happened? And so this hearing on the 20th, yesterday, in the court of Judge Steve Siegel, who has taken over the case from Paul Burdick, and he won't be the judge hearing the case down the road. It's going to be assigned to still another judge, which we have Judge Roulette going on here, which is kind of depressing and dangerous for the remaining four defendants, because though I have not a lot of good things to say about Paul Burdick, I have a lot of even worse things to say about the other judges. Burdick was the judge who heard this case over 2 years and got mightily sick of it, although he insisted on carrying it forward in ways that I think were completely inappropriate, considering not just the lack of evidence, not just the political persecution and dimensions involved, but the fact that the district attorney assigned to the case, Rachel Young, had committed transgression after transgression, contempt of court after contempt of court incident, and just refused to provide the discovery that she was supposed to provide. She either refused or was incompetent in doing it. And in so doing, she was dragging the defendants, none of whom were responsible for any vandalism. And that's the key to this. Through courts, several lost their jobs, several lost their teaching credentials, one attempted suicide, several lost their housing. It had serious impacts on the defendants, and you might say, well, they might be guilty, you know. Political protesters being charged with these kinds of crimes and facing these kinds of consequences exerts a chilling impact on all political protest in Santa Cruz. So it was that the only person standing on the median, except for one photographer who came to take pictures of it, at the rally supporting the black community in Ferguson, Missouri, after the murder of Michael Brown, and then the second murder of a man whose name I'm not familiar with, but probably will look at sometime during the show. Actually, I don't know if he had been shot dead by that time. I think he had, actually. There was a march on Sunday, last Sunday, around that. I was the only one standing on the median with a sign. Everyone else was afraid to violate the law, or nervous about it, or didn't want to take a chance in getting a ticket. Although everybody did take a chance in Moss and walking down the streets of Santa Cruz without a permit. And good for them. Good for them. And good for us. I did too. I didn't make the whole protest, but I made a part of it. And it was quite an interesting situation. I may be playing some of the speeches, if not tonight, then possibly Sunday when I have a longer show. In any case, there were a number of things that happened this weekend. There were a couple of rallies, one for Laney Sherman, another for Bruce Van Allen, which I got to. And then there was this march on the town clock, to the town clock, on behalf of ending racial profiling in Santa Cruz. So there wasn't that much talk about it. It was a very young crowd. It was impressive that young people are, you know, that outraged about it. It was kind of there was a somewhat anti-anarchist quality to it for those who are into these kinds of distinctions, not from the right but from the left, in the sense that there was concern about issues of gender and gender identity and self-identification, in terms of discrimination, which is an issue I've not followed very closely, you know, quite candidly. And, you know, my personal pronouns were corrected in the course of the discussion with some of the folks afterward. And I was given a chance to speak, as were others, some of whom actually, when they were kind of brushed aside, they were they took the mic and they spoke. Anyway, that was one of our radio broadcasters and an occasional visitor to my show, Michael O'Grady. It was a fairly free, it was certainly more free flowing than any of the candidate forums that I've seen. Candidate forum that happened on Monday, which was held at the Loudon Nelson Center and was featured the city council candidates for the Santa Cruz City Council. None of whom are very, very good. They're all pretty bad. But some Huff members support Bruce Van Allen and Laney Sherman. I don't, at least not yet. I'm still waiting for their positions. I don't believe their rhetoric. I want to see what, A, they are really committed to doing, and then what they have actually done in the last 2 decades that might give us some indication about how they're really likely to act in their day-to-day lives and in, you know, in terms of the associations they have and the accomplishments they've actually accomplished. It was a pretty old crowd for these candidate rallies, and the issues were water and, I think, needles. And Bruce Van Allen did give a spirited speech the day before at his Harvey West Sunday rally. Again, mostly older folks my age in their 50s, 60s, and 70s and up. But nonetheless, good food to eat if you could get there. But what we are now reaching is the Santa Cruz 11 affair. And this, again, as I said, was the Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo was directed by Judge Siegel to bring its records into court and show whatever records it had regarding a loan that was made, according to the election authorities, and Bob Lee supposedly reported in the 2010 election of $34,000, and to bring all records in. Well, the attorney for Wells Fargo, after an hour and a half, the show started. It was supposed to schedule for 8:15, didn't really get going till 9:15, 9:30, thereabouts, because Alexis Briggs, the attorney for Cameron Lorando, who was the one making these motions, he's one of the Santa Cruz, the final four of the Santa Cruz 11, was coming from San Francisco, and there was all kinds of stalling on the freeways. It transpired that the Wells Fargo had no records of any loan, which Judge Siegel did not inquire into this. He just said, oh, okay, you got no records? Well, that solves that. You said you've been asked to produce all the records. The fact that you claim that you are having no records, that's what you're saying. So that's that. What's next? And what seems to be next in this, and we're going to hear it from Alexis Briggs herself, may be the subpoenaing of the DA Bob Lee himself to talk about issues and what he did in terms of Wells Fargo lending him money and so forth. And the issue isn't really whether, you know, I've called Bob Lee the bag man for Wells Fargo. And what that really means is, in his prosecution of the Santa Cruz 11 and the Final Four, he has demanded these poor people, poor meaning money-less pretty much people, kick down $20,000. It was more actually before, but documents showed Wells Fargo was inflating its so-called damage figures. But Bob Lee is demanding restitution as a primary condition of settling this case without it going to another $100,000 trial. It's already been $100,000, $150,000 of the taxpayer money this far, with 7 cases already dismissed, mine being one of them. And so, if you don't like political activists, don't like me, don't like the activists involved, feel that the private property of Wells Fargo is a sacred thing that must be protected come hell or high water, and people punished who dare to transgress onto their sacred grounds, no matter how abusive they are to their victims. Whatever you may think about that, you might wonder at the cost of all this, and not just in terms of money, as I said, hundreds of thousands of dollars, but also in terms of court time that is being taken up. I mean, Take Back Santa Cruz and other groups have been rampaging and raging around about public safety, which I think is largely a phony issue. is always an issue of public safety. You know, I mean, police usually get there later, too late, for it to deal with anything. Unless you're talking about, you know, a homeless man sitting by the side of a building, people camping outside. In that case, they can serve as a nice, nasty security force for NIMBYs and gentrification folks and businesses downtown. But public safety, if you're really concerned about public safety, one would think you would want the murder cases, the rape cases, the assault cases to get, you know, priority in the courts instead of political prosecution to, you know, burnish the badges of Chief Vogel and salvage the reputation of DA Bob Lee, that he isn't wasting time because this is a very important issue that somehow, even though the police force couldn't identify anybody who actually did any vandalism and only arrested 11 out of the more than 100 people who are in that bank, and they had an opportunity to arrest them all at any time in the sense that they could have started issuing citations. And I've talked about this before. When this protest began, there was a large, angry crowd of people in front of the bank demanding that the police back off. But this group didn't have weapons. They just linked arms, and they were angry. The police were the ones with the weapons. They had the CS gas, which they brought but didn't use. They had the batons, the guns, the tasers, chokeholds, if they want to use them. They do still, according to documents that I've gotten from the police department recently. But they didn't because they wanted to resolve it peacefully. Good for them. Good for Chief Vogel. But then to turn around 3 months later and attempt to use it as a weapon to go after political activists they don't like myself, Becky Johnson, Brent Adams, Bradley Allen, Alex DeRosi, these are reporters as well, and Gabriella Ripley Phipps. This is nasty, punitive, politically motivated, abusive stuff that has nothing to do with real public safety. It has to do with trying to punish a political perspective and activists who they find irritants or even threats, although it's hard to imagine finding us threats. I wish we were in some ways a threat. And I wish there was a real prospect of overturning racial profiling, overturning police abuse, overturning rental profiteering in Santa Cruz, but we are nowhere near that. I wish we were, and I hope the program, hope that somewhere down the line people have had enough of this shit. And you can see how people can cause a stir in Ferguson. And I don't necessarily mean by rioting, although rioting does cause a stir, and rioting is a natural consequence of violence against a population by a minority, in this case a white supremacist minority, that has ruled in Ferguson for some time, and in this country for some time, actually, if you want to consider it fairly and honestly. So, Santa Cruz 11 is what we're talking about. I'm taking a half an hour to get around to it, but now I'm going to do it. Let's hear some reports from what happened. This was Tuesday, the 20th of August. Actually, no, I guess it was the 19th of August. No, it was Wednesday, the 20th, and I was in court, and you can actually listen in, too. I wasn't actually in the courtroom. They don't allow you to make a public record in the courtroom. You see, you're just the public. You don't have the right to do that. You have to go buy a transcript and get the judge's permission and so forth. It's a rigged scene, but I did catch some interviews and opinions around this outside the actual courtroom, Department 6.
So, while I'm here in the corridors of the Halls of Justice, where the only justice is in the halls, with Becky Johnson and David Silva, we're waiting outside Department 6 for Alexis Briggs, attorney for Cameron Lorando of the Santa Cruz 11, to come down from the Bay Area, and that has not happened yet. So, while we're waiting, a quick report from Becky Johnson on the People's Democratic Club's candidate forum 2 nights ago, featuring, I guess, almost all, if not all, the candidates. I think there were 7 of the 8 or something.
7 of the 8, Gary Knudsen was the only no-show. So remember that at ballot time, people.
You know, I came there briefly, and I noticed the room was pretty packed. Almost all the seats were taken. There were chocolate chip cookies available and literature. Even my flyer was available. So Becky, you were... what happened to the People's Democratic Club that struck you? I, as I said, was almost... Well, I left early because I thought it was very boring. So.
It was pretty much boring to tears, many of the answers. But there was one exception, and that was when the needle exchange came up. And it became...
Heated?
I had very surprising comments from a number of the candidates. It looked like... five out of the seven candidates supported the needle program.
The current one or the previous one?
The previous one, including Mike Pruger, who is a former Santa Cruz Police Department. And
it should be clarified for those who haven't been following this. Last year, under pressure from needle hysteria led by the Clean Team and Take Back Santa Cruz and perhaps the Santa Cruz neighbors, the City Council in closed session voted to pressure an end to SOS, the voluntary needle exchange program in the city that was serving regularly at Barson Street near Canfield. And there had not been complaints in that area that were, at least that I'd ever heard, around, you know, improper needle disposal. I heard one complaint at one point after a lot of needle shaking and rattling, and my children are in danger of finding needles because there were suddenly these massive attempts to scour the landscape for needles, the beaches, the distant areas in the Poganip which hadn't been cleaned up for years, and they found needles, you know, but they didn't point out that the number of needles they found was like 0.01%. I'm not quite sure if that figure is right, but an almost infinitesimal number of needles compared to the number that were properly disposed of. And, of course, funding was cut for needle exchange. Anyway, the issue was a hot one last year. The City Council voted behind closed doors to force it to shut down. That's the needle exchange program that was ended through the cowardice of the City Council. And I wondered if any of the candidates actually was willing to say, I want to see the Barson Street needle exchange reopened. And I didn't stay for that. Those who are watching that on community TV will know if that's the case. But, of course, it's probably not possible anymore because of the hysteria raised around it and the fears of the landlord and the politically jumpy response of the Santa Cruz City Council. Its willingness to succumb to right-wing mythology, no matter how absurd and counterfactual. It would still be interesting to know if some candidates are willing to say this is complete horseshit. Because that's one thing that Steve Plaich, for example, publicly, even though he had worked in needle exchange for a long time and worked with that group for a long time, didn't really make clear public statements on. In fact, when he went to the Board of Supervisors and they were considering an alternate program, which they've set up, which is much more restrictive than the earlier program in Santa Cruz that was in the city. And there is no needle exchange in the city of Santa Cruz now, at least nothing based in there anymore. It's been essentially removed from that area. We've retreated into the Middle Ages in Santa Cruz on that issue. But people have been afraid to talk about it because they don't want to offend the raging, venomous idiots on the right on this issue. And so here we have Becky Johnson saying that one of the candidates, Officer Pruger, who I think has arrested me in the past, he's not an officer anymore, he was an officer. I think actually it was Pruger and Vogel when they were both beat cops who were in sort of part of the regular homeless harassment squad back in 1988 when I first began a lot of activism myself in Santa Cruz. But in any case, now he's running for city council. I don't know what his current positions are. I suspect that they aren't my positions, but who knows? Becky Johnson apparently took heart from the fact that her impression was that people favored a return to needle exchange prior to as it was before it was destroyed by the Santa Cruz City Council and the city. However, on further questioning, I kind of found that didn't seem to be at least really explicitly stated. But let's hear some more. Again, this is us, Becky and myself, waiting for the Santa Cruz, the hearing on whether Bob Lee's Wells Fargo records are going to be revealed, and then suddenly they dog-ate the records at Wells Fargo, so they weren't. There are no records, suddenly. How that can happen is interesting. And who knows how that can happen? Here we are talking about the two evenings before at the People's Democratic Club, where there was a forum on city council candidates talking issues.
Sheriff running for office, he said he supports the needle program as a police officer because he doesn't like to reach into suspects' pockets and get poked by needles, and he thinks the needle exchange program reduces the amount of used needles that are found just anywhere.
And there was one candidate who supported ending the needle program or opposed the previous one?
Well, the two, David Terrazas did not jump up and say he was in favor of the former needle exchange program, not surprisingly. And then Rochelle Noroyan also seemed to balk on that, but she didn't really give a clear position. But all the other candidates, Laney Sherman and this Craig guy and... I'm not remembering all their names.
Bruce Van Allen
said he vigorously supports the former needle exchange program. He says the science is in. It prevents disease. It prevents the spread of HIV and hepatitis. And it reduces the amount of used needles found in the environment. And he was vigorously for it. So that really kind of surprised me.
Did the words Barson Street come up?
Only in a veiled way, where I think it was Laney Sherman said that she supported a needle exchange being in some kind of mobile van that could drive around to different locations and not be associated with a particular location.
None of them really did support the Barson Street needle exchange by name. I mean, let's be straightforward about this.
I think you're incorrect on that, Robert. I think.
Well,
that,
did they use the word Barson Street?
They did not use the word Barson Street, but five of the seven made it clear they wanted to return to the previous needle exchange program as it was before the city council machinations basically drove it out.
Except for Laney, who wants a mobile exchange, which is harder to deal with because you can't go to a spot and know that you're going to be able to exchange needles.
That seemed additive to me, not reductive, but you know, perhaps you're right.
I tend to think rather critically of the candidates until I'm otherwise informed, and that could be, you know, an inaccurate bias on my part. You know, you could be right too, Becky. Anything else come up that was of note? Did anything about Ferguson and Bruce Van Allen was very eloquent on his Sunday. I will support. You know, he held his hands up and said, don't shoot, and all that sort of thing in solidarity with the Ferguson majority that's being harassed by the white minority there and the police. But did any of that come up at this matter?
I think there was a reference to it, but also the issue of homelessness did come up under the rubric of affordable housing. But that also became fairly, people got a little hot about it, and it seemed like many of the candidates were unhappy with the current policy towards homeless people, that they felt that it's not working, and that some...
Unhappy in what way? That there are too many of them damn homeless hanging out?
No, not at all. It was the other way, that they felt there weren't enough services for homeless people and they wanted to increase housing options and services for homeless people, which they felt were underfunded. And so that was a little bit of a surprise, too. I thought there'd be more people jumping on the bandwagon of who's going to be more punitive to those
homeless. Is there any of that punitive stuff mentioned?
I think the people who maybe support that decided to stay a little quiet at this particular forum. I think what you need to do is go to the Chamber of Commerce forum and see what people say there to a completely different audience.
You know, the audience, as I said, looked pretty packed, and I recognize many of the, you know, the old gullibles or the old faithfuls, or what do you want to call them, who were sitting in the audience. I mean, I think Chris Krohn was there with Rachel, and there was a couple of Huff members who showed up and were distributing Huff literature. I was impressed with that, Elise, and I guess Sherry. And I don't think you were distributing literature, but you were there, to your credit, and we're getting a good report from you. What did you notice about the crowd, and did you mingle with the crowd afterward?
Well, I didn't stay to the end, but I did. I, like you, recognize probably half of the people there by name, and they're not necessarily friends of mine. In fact, some of them, like, say, Tim Fitzmaurice, is someone who I've been on the opposite camp with many a time. It seemed the only thing was missing were the current council members. I didn't see anyone from
David Tourette's.
Well, he's running for re-election and was on the forum. I'm talking about, you asked in the audience there.
Yes, I did.
And I didn't see any of the current sitting council members, and very few former mayors. Celia Scott was there, but gee, she hasn't been mayor since 96, so she's kind of like a has-been too.
Well, she's an activist, at least in some respects, although I again don't remember her being particularly vocal as homeless people's camps are being destroyed and their property being seized and people being falsely charged in the Santa Cruz 11 case. I don't remember her coming out on that issue. In fact, I don't remember anybody in that room, mostly. Maybe Steve Plaich, I think, who was there. And maybe, you know, obviously Brent Adams, who was one of the Santa Cruz 11. Maybe a few Huff members.
Well, 2 years ago, I asked Rochelle Naroyan to have a statement one way or the other, supporting or opposing the prosecution of the Santa Cruz 11. And she said she didn't know much about it, but she'd get back to me. So
you're still waiting?
Still waiting.
You might give Rochelle a reminder call.
Rochelle, are you listening? What's your position on the Santa Cruz 11? Are you for continuing prosecution of the whistleblowers, or are you think that $100,000 prosecuting people for protesting is maybe a little bit too much? What is it, Rochelle? Which is it?
Mm. Well, I've seen Rochelle on the Facebook pages sort of snuggling up to the Take Back Santa Cruz-ish type commentators, and so I don't really have a lot of confidence in her. I have zero confidence in her, actually. But I also note some of the supporters of the Santa Cruz 11. We had one here a moment ago, and we are, of course, sitting in the corridors of the court outside a hearing that is supposed to be around the issue of Wells Fargo Bank's documents around their support for or loans to D.A. Bob Lee in his election campaign, how this might influence his partiality or the appearance of his partiality in the Santa Cruz 11 case, which is primarily concerned, Lee has acknowledged himself, with providing restitution to along the tune and to the amount that Wells Fargo Bank has specified it wants for its vacant, unused, and now 5-year vacant 75 River Street property. So who knows what's going to happen with that one, if anything's going to happen today. Well, 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 look who shows up. Just as I mentioned it, only an hour and a half late.
An hour
late. All right. We're talking with Becky Johnson outside the court where...
And the person who just showed up was Alexis Briggs, the attorney we were all waiting for, attorney for Cameron Lorando, the one who was making the motion to let Wells Fargo show its records to indicate whether Bob Lee is a fit prosecutor given the fact that he seems to have taken money from Wells Fargo, or at least used their services, and then not made that explicit, that that was a concern, and that people should be aware of that. And I guess Alexis Briggs wants to have the state attorney general's office proceed with this prosecution, if it's going to proceed at all. That's not likely, but let's hear some more.
It's just been ruled that the Wells Fargo attorney, confronted with a demand for records, any and all records in the last 5 years of loans between Bob Lee or to Bob Lee from Wells Fargo, specifically a $34,000 loan, which appears in the, I guess, state or county election records of contributions. Wells Fargo insists it has no records whatsoever of any loans, including that $34,000 loan. Becky, your thoughts?
Well, Bob Lee filed papers with his campaign with the Elections Commission, where he reported that he'd gotten a $34,000 loan from Wells Fargo, and then a month or two later, he filed papers saying that that $30,000 had already been paid back, and there was, I think,
$32,000.
I think there was $2,000 he still owed.
You didn't see these documents, but you're taking this from the Sentinel stories or Alexis Briggs, or
no? That was what the Wells. That's what Alexis Briggs said in court about, you know, that she based this motion on, were these campaign election documents that Bob Lee filed in 2010. Which are required by law for if you get any finances for your campaign, you're supposed to report that. So he reported that he'd gotten a $34,000 loan from Wells Fargo, and then a month or two later reported that $32,000 had been paid off, and that indicated in the box that zero interest was paid. Now, today, in court, the representative from Wells Fargo, who drove down from San Francisco main office and testified in court that he had searched records and for the past 5 years, and they could find zero records of any loan being made to Bob Lee by Wells Fargo during that time period, at which point they said, well, it's a mystery what's going on. Well, it looks pretty darn suspicious. It looks like Bob Lee got an interest-free loan from Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo has dumped the evidence. That's what it's looking like.
You're such a suspicious woman, but you have a little T-shirt on that says, I was in the building, by the sworn testimony of SCPD officer William Winston, January 8, 2013. So you're, in fact, not a disinterested party.
Oh, no, I was one of the Santa Cruz 11. I was a defendant in this case, and I was charged with felonies in this case for 11 months. I lost my housing because of this case. I lost, it was very expensive for me, thousands and thousands of dollars that I had to pay as a direct result of my prosecution in this case. And yet when I got to my preliminary hearing 11 months later, there was no evidence to charge me, despite Officer Winston testifying under penalty of perjury that he saw me go into the building, which is impossible because I never went in the building.
A likely story, Johnson.
Well, now because Officer Winston has testified, it becomes a fact, whether it happened or not.
Oh, well, no, Officer Winston has an unsoiled and unsullied reputation for not just honesty, but gentle treatment of homeless people on Pacific Avenue.
Yeah, he's a real gentle midget.
That is what we call a dry and ironic comment. Winston has, at least some years ago, a couple years ago, when he was assigned to Pacific Avenue, there were regular complaints about his behavior toward homeless people.
And we've been talking with
Becky Johnson.
Thank you, Becky.
I'm paying for child care.
So we're walking with the that hardworking driver and attorney, Alexis Briggs, as well as her compatriot,
Lisa McCamey,
who's also an attorney in the Santa Cruz 11 case. So you just had a lengthy chat with, thank you, David, with the county council about this strange situation where they seem to be missing documents that the Wells Fargo, the county has a record of a loan that the Wells Fargo does not. Is that the bottom line?
What we have is documentation from the regarding campaign finance for Bob Lee from 2010 that on its face appears to indicate that a loan was made by Wells Fargo to Bob Lee. We have been informed by both county council representing Bob Lee and council representing Wells Fargo, a private firm representing Wells Fargo, not in-house counsel for Wells Fargo,
right,
that no documents exist relating to a loan made in the last 5 years.
But they could be lying. Ah, but that would be under penalty of perjury.
Suspicious. Documents can be destroyed. I would not assert that perjury is being committed.
Good
in
point.
This situation. And on the record...
We're talking about attorneys here.
On the record, county council indicated to the court that there might be an innocuous explanation for why campaign records appear to exist that are not matched by other...
I've got my request for an investigator in. It just hasn't been approved.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. Okay. So there appears to be campaign finance documents, and it appears that neither party referred to in that documentation has any paperwork relating to such a loan, including copies of that same campaign documentation. That's what was in. That's what was told to court. County Council says they have an innocuous explanation. The court said that that wasn't relevant to today's proceedings. I merely made the request to County Council as to what that may be. And he's
talked to Uncle Bob first.
He has a client that he needs to speak with before having any conversations with me directly.
So,
and that's all I know.
So the issue, I guess, to me is, well, there are a couple things. First of all, we have a new judge in the case, so which you probably don't want to alienate him immediately by making public statements pro or con.
I don't have any prior experience with him to make any judgments.
Well,
he's been fair and even-handed the times that I've been here to appear on this fairly complicated matter.
Yes. Now, what about the...
That judge is Steve Siegel, who hasn't been much in criminal court, at least not in Santa Cruz, in the last decade. He used to be, he was originally a commissioner when I first got involved in legal matters in Santa Cruz in the late 80s. And he was a relatively, certainly a better judge than the other ones. Well, not quite as good as Phil Watts, who was really constantly concerned with, or at least seemed to be willing to dismiss many, many cases of homeless people engaged in non-criminal behavior that was being treated as crimes, like sleeping. And the particularly around protesters. But don't know much about Siegel. We don't even know if he's going to be the judge who's going to be on this case if it goes to trial, which the prosecution insists is going to happen, the Santa Cruz 11, the final four. And there's going to be another hearing on the 27th coming up next Wednesday at 9 o'clock, where there will be a ruling on whether the information provided or missing in the Bob Lee Wells Fargo brouhaha justifies removing Bob Lee from the case. I'm not holding my breath here. That's going to be 9 o'clock on the 27th of August.
I got the impression that he felt that even if these documents were there, it might not be relevant to a recusal motion.
He indicated that it might not be sufficient to warrant a recusal if they're the same types of loans that anyone could obtain from a bank.
Right. The question is whether some special privileges were given to Bob Lee.
Yes, that's what he indicated. It wasn't directly relevant to today's ruling, so it is sort of a preview as to what his perspective may be next Wednesday when we come back on the recusal motion. We'll see what happens.
Now, the documents that you did present, what exactly are they? Who are they presented to? What office do they represent?
I'm not entirely clear on all of that. A private investigator obtained them. They've been presented to the court, and they are campaign finance records. As I indicated, I'm a criminal defense attorney, so I don't spend a lot of time looking at campaign finance documentation.
And it's an office involving campaign finance records.
Right.
So would that be somebody else to subpoena?
One wonders whether or not a Public Records Act request needs to take place. Currently, what we have in front of the court is some evidence of a financial relationship. The question remains what the financial relationship actually consists of.
Uh-huh. And so this enters year two and a half of this case.
Yes,
is this your longest case ever? Or not?
I think it... From beginning to end, I believe it's the longest I've been with an individual case. There are 35 defendant federal gang drug cases that have taken about this long. But
well, this is a very serious case of people being in a building in a protest.
In a vacant building, which I believe as I drive out, we'll see it's still vacant.
Still vacant, yeah. Although some people have slept outside and been charged with trespass.
There have been
but not felony trespass, no.
Well, this is felony vandalism.
I'm sorry.
So if, while they were sleeping on the lawn, others were able to sneak on and cause damages over $900, then they might be facing similar charges. That's the legal theory of the felony
charges. What's coming up next week?
Next week is a motion to recuse the district attorney's, the entire office, as a result of Bob Lee's failure to disclose, not necessarily just that he has a financial relationship, but that he also failed to disclose that he has a financial relationship.
Is there a requirement to disclose in any legal sense?
That's probably a much more the question when it comes to recusal is whether there's an appearance of impropriety, an appearance of unfairness, and I believe if one were to say up front regarding your relationship with a victim, then the appearance may be dispelled. Whether or not there's a California Bar Association ethical obligation to disclose is a different question. Were he to represent two people with conflicting interests, then yes, there's an obligation for him to disclose to both parties. Here, when he's opposing one, he doesn't technically represent a victim, he technically represents the people of California. So in his position as district attorney, it's more nuanced than a normal conflict of interest for a civil attorney, for
example.
You may
have seen the video that has him in dialogue with myself and other Santa Cruz 11 defendants saying, if this restitution with Wells Fargo is dealt with, quote, it's a whole different ball game. Do you remember?
I do. It became the subject of one of the pieces of evidence that the former assistant district attorney, Rebecca Young, had not actually turned over all discovery relating to the matter. While on YouTube observing that video, it was seen that there was a whole slew of other videos posted by the district attorney without sound that had not yet been provided to defense counsel, and that led eventually to me requesting and obtaining monetary sanctions for violating various discovery orders.
Very limited monetary sanctions.
It is still an unprecedented.
Nothing that needs to be reported to the bar that might actually result in serious penalties for Rebecca Young.
Well, Ms. Young is no longer practicing law, and she's relocated to Texas. So,
have you been chatting with her lately?
No, but Google is a powerful engine.
I did see one of her stories. She's now writing for a paper there.
So the First Amendment has become very significant for her. So that seems to have served its purpose. But the question regarding whether or not there would be sanctions for Bob Lee himself is a separate question, since that's where the sanctions were actually directed. And again, we run into some issues between him as a person who may have received a loan, him as the office that is now making a filing decision, and according to some appearances in court, there's some a supervisor or someone that is now holding the authority for negotiating for resolving the case. So it appears to be something that Mr. Panato isn't able to make a different offer than all restitution jointly and severably. And what that means is $20,000 each defendant would be liable for not only their part, but if another defendant failed to make payment, they would still be in debt until the whole $20,000 is paid off, however that's paid. And that's one.
$23,000 or $20,000?
Likely, given some new discovery, it would be $20,000.
So there was been reduced twice now.
There was some significant overbilling that was discovered in preparation for the trial that was set time before last.
What else is coming up next week? The Rubin's motions for discovery or for recusal?
Jesse Rubin, who's representing Angel Alcantara, has motions asking for a dismissal. Statements were made that misdemeanors would be extended if defendants could make payments up front, and he's alleged that that is a prejudicial and biased against his client because his client is too poor to be able to afford a misdemeanor. The record indicated that Judge Burdick considered it strong-arming, though I don't believe he completed the sentence in which he was describing it
and
that
he's
way.
He's no longer on the case.
He's no longer on the case, but it was...
Siegel on the case, or Siegel's going to represent someone else? Or he seemed to indicate that they might be taking the case.
It hasn't been assigned out for trial yet. It hasn't been scheduled for trial yet, so we don't know which court would have the time to do the trial. So we're in front of Siegel, but the question remains when the trial will be scheduled for once we're done with these motions, which, to get back to that, Jesse Rubin's also seeking to have a hearing on restitution so that we can actually nail down what the alleged related costs were, whether they were associated or not under the law, and also to figure out how much of that might be relevant.
Restitution to Wells Fargo.
Restitution to Wells Fargo. It may impact negotiations. It may impact what evidence gets admitted at trial. So he's asking to recuse the DA for making a strong-armed offer. He's requesting a dismissal based on prejudicial conduct because of the financial situation. The four defendants can't afford a misdemeanor. He's asking for hearings on the
court. A misdemeanor, what does that mean? I'm sorry.
It means that if any of them had $20,000, then they could purchase a misdemeanor offer for all four of them.
Becky had a question.
Is DA Bob Lee likely to testify at one of these hearings?
As was discussed today, the next step is to see whether or not an evidentiary hearing is necessary. As to whether or not Bob Lee would be a relevant witness remains to be seen. I do understand apparently he has some significant health issues. I still don't understand the scope of what those are, and those might raise an issue regarding testifying as well.
You had a conference with the county council that went on for some length in the corridor, which we referred to at the beginning of this interview. I guess you expect to have a chat with him, and or is that all off the record? Although I recorded every bit of it, as you know. No, I didn't, actually.
My preference would be any reference to my conversation with county council outside of the courtroom to be off the record. I understand that it was in a public
bar association case that we have here.
It was in a public hallway, and the base. It wasn't a conference. The basis of it was simply me following up on something that county council said on the record in court regarding why we would have what appear to be campaign finance documentation that is not followed up with any bank records either by Bob Lee or Wells Fargo, and he has not made any promises one way or the other or made any representations or any explanations, but I did provide him my contact information.
And perhaps we'll get in touch with you, or perhaps you'll get in touch with Bob Lee by subpoena.
One hopes that it doesn't come to that, but we'll see.
Bob got such a nice figure in court. He's tall, he's distinguished.
I've only seen him on the YouTube video in which he was discussing with some of the former
defendants. That you've got here? What does this mean? How is your child going? You want to get into your personal life a bit.
Getting into my personal life. Yes, I did cut my hair. This is the only case that I have remaining before I take some time off to raise the child.
How old is this child?
She is 8 months old, and so it's interesting spending most of my time with her and then popping back into this very strange and twisting and turning case.
You've got the judge do some babysitting. Would be a much more functional use of the court's time.
I don't know. I wouldn't say that.
Necessarily.
So far, as I said, I believe that the court's been very fair, both in the case of Judge Burdick and in the case of Siegel. Of course, I wish that this entire matter would have been dismissed against my client a number of times, and I don't believe that there is sufficient evidence to have held him to answer. I believe dismissing the charges against him the first time was the right outcome. That is still my hope.
Huge amount of money has been spent on this case. I mean, we predicted. You at one point suggested it might not be unreasonable to say $100,000 would be the cost of a felony trial for these final four. Is that still your estimate?
We have to be well past that now.
No, I mean in terms of the actual new amount of money. Of the 2 weeks of trial you estimated would cost.
I believe 3 weeks. The last time we were in court, in front of Burdick, the district attorney indicated that he had 50 people that he was anticipating calling, so I don't know if 3 weeks is even a reasonable estimation. So it's on par to the cost of having a gang trial.
Which would be how much?
I'm not sure. Probably a couple $100,000, but I don't know what everyone...
We've gone from $100,000 to $300,000, perhaps. Becky has another question.
Well, Aram James in Palo Alto, he estimated that a jury trial costs $10,000 a day.
Okay.
Does that include felony trials? Is there any difference?
I'm not sure. Well, misdemeanor trials don't always have a... I guess bench trials would be cheaper because you don't have jury costs, and sometimes they go more quickly because you don't need to bring juries in and out. But we are also in a situation, perhaps the cost for the trial itself, you know, the judge and clerks, et cetera, but we also have three appointed attorneys. And here now we also have county counsel involved and the district attorney, so that's five attorneys that are being paid for by taxpayers to litigate this process.
Well, we don't want to forget severance pay for Rebecca Young.
I don't believe she was fired, nor that severance was offered.
I commend you for standing up for the honor of your unworthy opponent, Rebecca Young. However, I don't think I could ever agree with you that this case shouldn't be called a bunch of horse shit to begin with, a huge expenditure of money, and an abuse against all 11 defendants, which I think attorneys can't usually say because they don't want to offend the court. But I'm saying it and hoping that at some place in your heart you agree with me.
As to my client, most certainly, I believe that there are individuals that may be in violation of a misdemeanor trespass, and there may be individuals that are guilty of felony vandalism. None of the latter category were ever identified, arrested, detained, or charged with anything. So it remains to be seen whether any of these four were in fact in violation of a misdemeanor trespass, but there's been no allegation so far that any of the four, and this is again through three preliminary hearings, that any of the four, that there's any evidence that they're responsible for any damage to the building itself.
Anything you wish to conclude with before you begin your lonely journey home?
Well, I'll be back to the lovely Santa Cruz next Wednesday.
And we've been talking with?
Alexis Briggs, attorney for Cameron Lorendo.
Thanks, Alexis.
Thanks.
I think most of musicians I know have what we call an albatross. And this is my albatross. I wrote it years and years ago. And now people want me to sing it over and over again. And so I do it. It hangs around my neck and thank goodness it's not stinking yet. It's got lots of words. It's called I'm Gonna Be an Engineer. When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. It's gonna be too high. When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang, I wore my corduroys. Everybody said, oh, they did it to annoy. But I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, can't you be a lady? Your duty is to make me the mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, and maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl. Dainty as a Dresden statue, gentle as a Jersey cow, smooth as silk gives creamy milk. Learn to coo, learn to moo, that's what you do to be a lady now. Well, when I went to school, I learned to write and how to read, some history, geography, and home economy. And typing is a skill that every girl is sure to need, to while away the extra time until the time to breed. Then I had the nerve to say, well, would you like to be? I says, I'm gonna be an engineer. No, you only need to learn to be a lady. The duty isn't yours for to try and run the world. An engineer could never have a baby. Remember, dear, that you're a girl. She's smart for a woman. I wonder how she got that way. You get no choice, you get no voice. Just stay mom, pretend you're dumb. And that's how you come to be a lady today. Then Jimmy come along and we set up a conjugation. We were busy every night with love and recreation. I spent the day at work so he could get his education. Well, now he's an engineer. He says, I know you'll always be a lady. It's the duty of my darling to love me all her life. Could an engineer look after or obey me? Remember, dear, that you're my wife. Well, as soon as Jimmy got a job, I began again. And happy at my turret lay the year or so. And then, the morning that the twins were born, Jimmy says to them, kids, your mother was an engineer. You owe it to the kids to be a lady. Dainty as a dish rag, faithful as a chow. Stay at home, you got to mind the babies. Remember, you're a mother now. Well, Well, every time I turn around, there's something else to do. Cook a meal, mend a sock, sweep a floor or two. Holding up the potty when the baby wants to poo. I was gonna be an engineer. You know, I really wish that I could be a lady. I could do the lovely things that a lady's supposed to do. I wouldn't even mind if only they would pay me. And I could be a person too. What price for a woman? You buy her for a ring of gold. To love and obey without any pay. You get your cook and your nurse, for better or worse. You don't need your purse when the lady is sold. Ah, but now the times are harder and me Jimmy's got the sack. I went down to Vickers, they were glad to have me back. But I'm a third-class citizen, my wages tell me that. And I'm a first-class engineer. The boss, he says, we pay you as a lady. You know you only got the job, cause I can't afford a man. With you I keep the profits high as maybe. You're just a cheaper pair of hands. You got one fault, you're a woman. You're not worth the equal pay. A bit you're tart, you're nothing but heart. Shallow and vain, you got no brain. You even go down the drain like a lady today. Well, I listen to my mother and I join a typing pool. I listen to my lover and I put him through his school. But if I listen to the boss, I'm just a bloody fool and an underpaid engineer. I've been a sucker ever since I was a baby. As a daughter, as a wife, as a mother and a dear. But I'll fight them as a woman, not a lady. Fight them as an engineer.
And that was Peggy Seeger, I Was Gonna Be an Engineer. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM. Unfortunately, we're not broadcasting right now. We're having a combination of antenna problems and antenna location problems. I'm probably as tired of talking about it as you are out there listening about it, or to it. We need a location, and we also need more technical expertise. If you're savvy about radio matters and you want to help Free Radio, please give a call to me. I'm not the chief boohoo, but I am an individual who's a member of the collective. I can kind of hook you up with folks who could use your expertise. And also, if you've got questions about anything, you can go to the website, which is freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Which is where you'll be hearing this from probably for the near future for a while, because we are not broadcasting, though it's hard to predict. We need a site to go to put up the antenna, and it has to be in the greater Santa Cruz area. So if you have any ideas, if you know anybody who has a tall tree or a second story in their property and who's willing to host us, do give a call. 423-4833 is my number, 423-HUFF. Or you can call, go to the Freak website and leave us a message there, freakradio.org. So, here's a couple of quick updates, or one anyway. There's a... I have a habit of making what's called Public Records Act requests. That is, request to the city that they cough up records about various topics, so we can see what the background is, what they're, who they're talking to, regardless of what their opinions are, what their actual behavior is. And, gosh, a while back, on August 11th, that's almost a week and a half ago, I sent them a record after the Mime Troupe event in the park. And you may remember, if you listened to my show right after the Mime Troupe, what I learned was that the Parks and Rec, for the first time ever, tried to stop the Mime Troupe show by demanding a permit and threatening to pull, or actually threatening to pull the permit they had always previously granted to the Mime Troupe, because of the stage was a few inches too high, although I think it's the standard stage and no other jurisdiction that I've heard of has ever objected to it, at least not according to the mime troop people. So I sent the following request in. I wanted to make available for viewing or forwarding in e-format any and all city documents referencing the San Francisco Mime Troop from January 1st, 2011 to the present. This would include correspondence between various city departments, officials, and agencies, any correspondence to and from the Mime Troop itself, and any outgoing correspondence to any individuals or agencies. And what I got back from Nidia Patino, is that they want to extend their time because they need to consult further sites for the documents and examine a voluminous amount of separate and distinct documents, examine information being requested for various departments and individuals, and they're going to kick it ahead to September 4th. So they have put off my request until then. I'm not upset by this. I don't see any foul play, although the behavior of Parks and Rec sounds like a form of the kind of habitual, that's not probably the right word, although in a way it is. It's more like knee-jerk right-wing reaction to essentially a leftist event. And do I see it as political? Well, perhaps. But it certainly is not in accord with the traditional reception given to the mime troupe when it comes to town, which is a free performance. They pay, they rent the space, they get a permit, and they should be allowed to do their thing. And it's, you know, they usually get a couple hundred people coming to their show. I'm no uncritical fan of the mime troupe. I do like a lot of their shows. I like a lot of the music in their shows, although I wish they would actually regularly put out their music. Certainly better than some of the other vanilla satire groups that are around, like the Capitol Steps. But the mime troupe has often been unresponsive to us, those of us who are homeless activists who want to have them at least mention, allow some time for announcements about, even work into their show some local political relevance, or have us be able to announce our concerns. And they... They've had a mixed reception from the mime troupe. When they were up at UCSC, they actually, I think they were trying to exclude us from even coming in. And I was distributing a flyer, Mime Troop or Mum Troop, at that time. But I think they're, and I remember back in 2010, the kind of the very famous example was they were playing in San Lorenzo Park, and about, I don't know, 300 feet away, there were 50 people sleeping outside in front of the courthouse. This was a year before the Take Back Santa Cruz event. I'm sorry, a year before the Occupy Santa Cruz event. And these were people who were trying to reclaim public space, trying to draw attention to the criminalization of the homeless at night, trying to draw attention to the court's abusive treatment of homeless people. In particular, one man, Robert Blindbear Facer, a 63-year-old guy who died shortly thereafter, the famous teepee maker, Amish minister, and apparently canoe paddler who claimed to have paddled down from Alaska to Santa Cruz, first to Sacramento and then to Santa Cruz. It's always sounded a little unlikely to me, but, you know, I don't know. Amish people do not use machines, and so he wouldn't travel by car. He traveled by foot wherever he went, since he didn't have a horse, or by boat. Anyway, so the records should be available, they say, to find out just what the Parks and Rec has been doing, why it was holding up on it, the permits for the mime troop, or trying to attack the permits, refuse the permits, revoke the permits. It's not too clear exactly which of these was the case, but there was this thing that happened 3 days before the mime troupe started doing its thing, had its scheduled show, and that was a matter of concern to particularly to Grant Wilson, who I interviewed on the subject, and that's where my information comes from, as well as a mime troupe worker herself. So another thing that happened recently this week, another place where I was distributing a flyer that you can find online, which is about police state in Santa Cruz and talking about how mainly the people, main people feeling the force of the police state at this time are those outside and to some extent racial minorities, youth, and I guess people, lower middle class people, Latinos as well, immigrants. So I was distributing this flyer at the Board of Supervisors where there was some an oral communication period, better than the one at the City Council, which is on recess this month. Board of Supervisors has been, it meets every Tuesday generally, I guess with some exceptions. And the first thing we're going to hear at the Board of Supervisors is Steve Plaich talking at the oral communications period, where you can talk about anything you want if it isn't on the agenda. And then we'll hear some other people talking about other issues, myself among them. Again, this all happened day before yesterday, Tuesday morning. And there was also some discussion of affordable housing, an attempt to change the money charged to developers who are supposed to set aside housing, if they're building housing, to have some of it for affordable housing. Now, this really doesn't have too much to do with housing that's really affordable to poor people, which would be extremely low and low income housing. I think affordable housing is like around $80,000 a year if you're making $80,000 a year. I think it's for a family of four. So, but let's hear some of this and see how it goes. And perhaps you can call in with your thoughts. 427-3772.
It passes unanimously. Now we'll take item 64. That'll be oral communications, which is an opportunity for members of the public to comment on items that are not on today's agenda but are within our purview. You'll have 3 minutes to do so. Good morning, Mr. Plaich. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Board. My name is Steve Plaich. I'm the Vice Chair of ACLU Santa Cruz County. On behalf of our 1,600 members, I've been asked to come to you this morning and read a statement of principle, and also to deliver a message. The statement of principle is as follows. The Santa Cruz County Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union supports, in principle, a limited-time moratorium on enforcement of camping ban laws and ordinances within the city and county of Santa Cruz on the grounds that such laws and ordinances selectively criminalize the homeless community. While the chapter is mindful that such a moratorium raises practical problems within the community at large, we believe that the benefits of such an approach in terms of the opportunity for civic leaders, policymakers, and stakeholders to reassess the efficacy of these laws and ordinances outweighs any temporary adverse impact. The message, gentlemen, is this. There are more than 3,500 unsheltered men, women, and children in our county every single night. And yet we have fewer than 700 emergency shelter spaces. So for the vast majority of those folks, they are at risk every night of citation and or arrest for the simple act of trying to find a safe place to sleep. This is a human rights issue. This is a civil rights issue. But for the ACLU, at the end of the day, it is a civil liberties issue. On that basis, we are fully engaged on this issue at this point, and moving forward, we will be petitioning and talking to the board at large, individual members, every policymaker, every stakeholder, every concerned citizen in this community about this issue. A change is going to come. A change must come in the way we treat people experiencing homelessness in our community. The ACLU has asked that I come today before you and tell you that that change starts right here, and it starts right now. Thank you.
And Steve is a very good speaker, of course, well-spoken, eloquent, orotund. Notice that the resolution itself talks about re-examine the efficacy of the sleeping ban. It doesn't talk about the morality of the sleeping ban. Doesn't talk about the civil liberties, the violations of due process, right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, right to travel, a number of other concerns that other civil liberties groups, including the ACLU, have raised in other jurisdictions, but just, gee, isn't it effective when moving these homeless people around? Doesn't it cost a lot of money? Yeah, it doesn't. So that, therefore, we should, you know, put it aside. I've got nothing against appealing to the taxpayers based upon whatever you want to use you think will be effective, provided you make it really clear what the basic issue is. Because otherwise we lose our moral compass. I've said this before in some of Plaich's presentations. That said, though, I want to point out that I did find, by email from Steve Plaich, that he is intending to go ahead at the next ACLU meeting, as I mentioned earlier in this broadcast, which is on Monday at 7 o'clock in Loudoun Nelson Center and open to the public at least the first 10 minutes of it. And I guess if you want to pay up and become an ACLU member, unless they change their rules again, which they seem to be doing depending on the whim of the chair, you'll be allowed to sit through the meeting, maybe even give some input. One of the issues on the agenda is going to be destruction of homeless property, which is happening regularly. But it's hard to document, and it's hard to get people to stay around to testify to, which is hard to get people to stand up and protest, or even come forward and put their names to acknowledgments, because they have to live in the same town as these cops. But it is, of course, a really key issue. It's one which resulted in a $2.3 million successful lawsuit against the Fresno city government and Caltrans there. And it's resulted in successful lawsuits in Los Angeles as well. So it's not inappropriate to bring it up, not that the ACLU is ever going to undertake anything of that kind. Although I believe the Steve Plaich or some of the other activists on that board, Jay Mithril, have are urging the Northern California Regional ACLU to take some action. They have more legal muscle and resources if they ever choose to use them on behalf of the homeless, which is not in our area. It's been almost never. Last time I heard of anything happening that even related to that was 1994. When there were massive protests against the sitting ban, and there was some support for some activists going to court and a successful overturning of the original sitting ban, which was then replaced by another sitting ban, which was not challenged in court. The current one we have, which was made worse over the years as a sort of a growing cancer, because if you don't nip these things in the bud, they tend to strangle you later, is at least it seems to be the case with our sitting ban. I've requested from Steve Plaich specifics about his information item that he's going to be putting on the ACLU Board of Directors agenda on Monday at 7 o'clock at Loudoun Nelson Center. And I just did that this evening, so I can't really tell you. Maybe on Sunday I'll have more information. I come back for a Sunday show from 9:30 to 1 o'clock. You can listen in then, perhaps, and get some more info. And now here's some more from the Board of Supervisors, Tuesday's meeting, the oral communications period.
Good morning, Ms. Johnson. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Becky Johnson. There's a sleeping ban in the city of Santa Cruz. It's illegal to sleep between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. anywhere outdoors or in a vehicle, subject to a $162 fine. Or now a homeless person who has money for a motel room certainly doesn't have money for this fine. What happens when this person actually gets cited and they get convicted and they're sentenced to perhaps community service, perhaps a fine that they can't pay? What happens to them? What happens is that they are less likely to be able to get a job, less likely to be able to get into housing. They're exhausted, harassed, feel like they are excluded from society because they are, by law, and by our police force, who, this is not an obscure law that is occasionally enforced. There are 60 citations issued every month. And for every citation issued, there's four or five move-alongs where a cop wakes someone up in the middle of the night and moves them along to nowhere because you do not have a shelter space to offer to that person. Now, when we had a protest right out in front of this building in 2010, what happened? Dana McCrae. trail here, dusting off the lodging law, an obscure law, a misdemeanor that prevents lodging, which is not defined, on both public and private property if you lodge without the permission of the owner. Well, who owns public property? Well, David McCrae said that the county officials own the public property, and therefore, a person who falls asleep in front of this building is guilty of a misdemeanor and should go to jail for 6 months. And what happened when some people got convicted? They were, Gary Johnson was sentenced to 2 years in jail for sleeping. Ed Fry, 6 months in jail. And that was punitive. Because this county is anti-homeless and anti-anyone who is advocating for homeless people and is using the force of the law to do this. And that lodging law was lifted from the 1851 Indiana Constitution using language preventing blacks and mulattoes from moving into the state of Indiana and lodging there. Racist and cruel.
And that's the supervisors last Tuesday, day before yesterday. Actually, on the line with us, say who you are, caller.
Darlene Zamora.
And Darlene, I think you made it to this Board of Supervisors meeting.
Yes, I did.
And we're actually going to be hearing what you had to say to them. But right now you're downtown in downtown Santa Cruz?
I'm off Branch 40 right now.
Ah.
I was earlier.
And you've talked a bit. I think this is your first call into free radio, right?
Second.
This is your second?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me. I know we've spoken off the air as well.
Yes.
And you've described how you've been concerned about how your son, who is homeless at night, and you've been keeping an eye on him because he chooses to be outside, and you wanted to give him, you know, that freedom to do that, and yet at the same time show some regard for his safety. You've observed some untoward behavior by police and security guards towards him and other people?
Yes. More of the very aggressive behavior, not so much from the security guards, because I think they feel a little sorry for my guy. But these are grown, young adults. And I hate to say it because they have first cousins that are African-American, but these are young African-American adults that for the past 2 months, I can sum it up, I'm not sure, but my son has been downtown transient, off and on, off his meds, and I put it together that these young adults, African-American descent, I'm sorry, I'm calling it the way I see it, have been terrorizing him, bullying him, taking his $50 Monday allowance money. He wasn't even able to buy cigarettes for himself because I think they were expecting it from him. He was the most unhappiest guy in the past month, few weeks, than I've ever seen him in his life. He was so angry I couldn't figure it out. Totally out of character, even off his meds. And what happened 2 mornings ago was these 6 to 8 big African-Americans, along with some Latinos that are married into their families, beat him to the point where he went over the edge and started running into traffic saying, I can't fight all these guys alone. There's too many of them. I might as well kill myself. So I had to commit him to an institution, sign over conservatorship, and give over my boy, whose father and uncle are military, grandfather, POW, World War II, so this guy can be safe off the streets, away from these hoodlums. They're not homeless. I've also experienced them picking on other homeless people. They're just terrorizing those homeless people and disabled people, playing on them.
Let me ask you a question or two. First of all, have you actually visibly seen this yourself? Or are you taking
yes,
this from...
Yes, I have.
Okay, when was the last time you saw this?
About a month ago, I was sitting at the Metro free parking with my son, because I was down there half the time watching over him. And I jumped out of my car because three African-American guys in the middle of the aisle between right in front of Andy's pet shop. We're stomping on his head, a homeless guy, a disabled. He looked like a mental health patient. Homeless, stomping on his head. I jumped out, ran up, and told those guys, you fight that man fairly, one-on-one.
Now, let me ask
and
you,
they,
this wasn't
yeah.
this wasn't your son. This was another person.
No, this was another guy. But since I did that, they started coming down harder on my son.
Well, let me ask you, what time of day was this incident?
This was
ago?
Broad daylight.
Uh-huh. And was anyone else observing or doing anything about
this?
No
one said anything. No one intervened.
What about the Metro security guards?
They're nowhere to be found. They don't even leave the premises. They observe, but they don't do anything. Hospitality is never around.
These guys
are running in packs.
How about the bus drivers?
I was down there today buying a taco on that little island.
And again, I'm talking about Darlene, the incident about a month ago.
Nobody. No one. No one went out to help that guy except me.
And did you, what was the result of your, after you went up and said, fight fair one-on-one, what did they do?
One of them goes, okay, I'll fight him one-on-one. And then I go, no, please don't. He's not well. And I kind of, shook his hand, please leave him alone. And he goes, okay, walked away, laughing. A group of them. And I told this homeless, and he's a mental health, I know. And I told that homeless guy, I said, don't do that. Don't bother. There's too many of them. You can't win. Let's just leave it alone.
Now, do you know the name of this guy that you helped?
I've seen him around, but ever since then, he's gone because people are actually hiding from these guys, okay, because they terrorize. Let me tell you how...
Hang on a second. I want to hear more, but let me ask you a few questions about this.
Okay.
You have a phone that takes photos?
It's full. I need to transfer them onto a disk.
Right.
Full.
Well,
I have that same
problem. But, yeah, I mean, if you're going down, downtown to do this kind of thing, it's a good idea to have, either have a phone that's available or else look like you have a phone that's available. That's the other thing. But so you've never taken photos of these people. And was this the only occasion where you saw this kind of incident happening, or did you see it on some other occasion?
Well, look, I had to commit my son because they drove him over the edge. He wanted to commit suicide. And since that was like Tuesday early morning. Since then, I'm downtown running errands, and they're intimidating me. Now they're intimidating me. I want to tell those mothers.
So when you say,
hang on,
when you say they, first of all, are you talking about a very specific
talking about the African Americans in this community that are ganging up, hanging around Taco Bell,
hang on. To use the phrase, there are a lot of African Americans in this community. There aren't that many, actually, but there are still
20-year-olds.
There are a sizable number of African Americans. And how many, are you talking about a few particular individuals, or are you making a racial claim?
I'm telling you that however you want to label it, 8, 6, 8, 10 African Americans beat my son down Tuesday 1 o'clock in the morning. And when I took him in the car, picked him up, and passed by him, they swarmed my car. They were going to pull
me
out of
my car. Okay, darling, this is the second incident that I'd like to, we have to examine in more detail. But the first incident involved what? Three guys on this one guy. You were saying?
Oh yeah, that was about a month ago. There were five of them. Yeah.
You say there were three or there were five? Which?
There were five of them walking by, and then two of them were kind of going over toward him, meeting him, and beating him up, fighting him. And he fell down, the homeless guy fell down, and one of them went and jumped on his head. And that's when I ran, because it terrorized me.
I broke
him up.
Right.
They just stomped on his head.
Okay, how far away were you from this incident when it started?
What? 15 yards.
Okay. And so
10 yards.
You say there were five guys involved in this, including and then the sixth guy was the victim.
Yes.
Okay. So and then you said there was another incident that happened. How much later, involving your son?
Okay. Ever since that incident, because they all know my son, he's there every day, pacing back and forth because that's where he used to play music downtown. About a month later, he just started being so angry.
Darlene, again, I'm trying to focus on... You saw an incident that happened at the Metro involving this, you know, this situation you just described. Then later, there was another incident you meant where involving your son directly, correct?
Yes.
When and where did that happen?
Hello?
I'm right here. When and where did that second incident happen?
Tuesday, about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Tuesday, you mean like 2 days ago? You mean like a week and a half?
Yes. The morning that I was at the Board of Supervisors office. Robert.
Okay, so on that day, where were you again when this happened?
I'm sitting in the Metro Free parking lot. I know my son's worried about something, so I'm sitting there babysitting him, letting
what
him pace it up and down
What time of day was this?
I was there all day, off and on, about 1 o'clock in the morning.
So you were there at 1 o'clock in the morning,
yep.
And you were there with your son, and then what happened?
He gets out of the car, and makes his round, and
Who gets out of the car?
My son gets out of his car,
car. Okay, thank you.
He goes, I'll be right back. I'm going to bum a cigarette.
Uh-huh.
Okay, he takes off one direction, and then comes the other direction from Taco Bell, but on the other side of the street. No, he comes and passes my car on the same side as Taco Bell. I go, Christian. He comes over to the car and starts yelling. They busted my chin. He was so pissed off. He says, get me the hell out of here. And I go, and he was bleeding from his hands. I go, what happened? He goes, just get me the hell out of here.
Okay,
I jump in my car. We take off.
Hold it. Whoa. I'm sorry. I want to ask you a question about that. So how long elapsed between the time he got out of the car and the next time you saw him as he came back with the bleeding chin?
30 minutes, 40 minutes.
So he was gone 30 or 40 minutes, you waited in the car, and then he came back, and then you had this conversation with him?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's our routine. I just walked
okay, and so,
back
and so the second incident you got as a report from him but didn't see directly, correct? Correct?
What was that, Robert?
The second incident, the one that you're talking about now, you did not see directly but got as a report from him and you saw his bleeding chin.
Yes, he said, they busted my chin.
So you have his report. So you don't know if this was the same group of guys, or did he say this was the same three guys, the same five guys?
Yes, because when he got in the car and they started surrounding my car.
Okay, now, when he got in the car, you say there were some. Then these people came up to your car.
Yes, we drove off and drove past them, and they started coming toward my car.
Now hold it. Where did you drive past them? Where were they when you drove?
Okay, I'm coming out of that free parking along in front of Metro. I pull out. I go left toward Taco Bell.
Right.
And there's that shop there. It used to be a head shop, posters and stuff.
Familiar with that?
Yeah. We're pulled up alongside the mural. I slow down there because they're hanging out there. And then they, as soon as I start slowing down to pass through, they come around the back.
Hold it. Let me ask you a question. How many people were hanging out there?
About six, eight. Big African-American men.
So you're saying every one of these individuals was black?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
So I, and as soon as I start slowing down to pass by him, my son said, get the hell out of here. And those guys heard him, and they said, yeah, you better get the hell out of here. And we took him to the emergency room from there.
Okay. Did you report any of this to the police department?
I'm making a police report because I'm going to have to eventually fight to get my son out from conservatorship, and I'm going to have to prove that he was pushed to the point of suicide behind this error, not because he's suicidal every day, but because he was pushed to that point.
So you actually, the incident which you initially described when you called in, you said your son ran out into traffic because he felt suicidal.
Yes.
What you said in this particular incident was that this is the incident that happened, the second incident. You're talking about the second incident, right, when you're referring to this. In other words, he's saying at 1 o'clock in the morning he walked out into traffic is what you're saying.
Okay, well, he didn't want to stay at the emergency room, so I found a new behavioral health unit because he was so out of control, so angry.
Okay.
he was pounding on the car. I'm going to die. I might as well die. I can't do this anymore.
Anyway, it's Darlene, I'm going to interrupt you because I'm right now I've got a time problem. I got to end the show in 15
okay.
minutes.
So
what I'm going to do now is, you know, people have heard your account, at least some of it, and I'm also going to be playing, you know, you spoke at the Board of Supervisors about this. What I encourage you or anyone to do who witnesses abuse, whether it's by black, white, green people on the streets, you know,
yes.
Particularly police officers who are particularly protected from any kind of transparency, is
yes.
to, you know, first of all, try to take a picture of it, try to make a note of the details when it happens, and be careful, though, of, I would say, you know, generalizations about particular individuals. When you use the phrase African Americans, and you know, you shouldn't. That's who you saw. There's no question about that. If that's what you saw, but you got to be careful that you know you're talking about. You apparently didn't see these individuals for any length of time. I didn't ask you whether
there was one earlier, Robert. One earlier that was giving my son a hard time,
and that was
he left and called these bigger guys.
Okay, so again, we you know, if I were to ask you more details, I'd have to find out when that was, what conversation you had with it, where it happened, and that's really to me the specifics that mean, you know, that give us the, you know, the nitty gritty of what happened. But I appreciate your, you know, giving us your thoughts. Anything you want to conclude with?
Yes, Robert. If they would have been Martians, I would have described them as Martians, Robert. I'm not racial profiling. They have black African American first cousins. The point is, he started running in traffic because he was so over the edge. And I'm going to file a police report, and I want to say to those mothers, shame on you for not teaching your kids any compassion. They're bullying the homeless. They're stomping on the disabled. It's wrong.
All right. Well, thank you, Darlene.
Yes, thank you, Robert.
Yeah, no problem. And let's take a brief musical break while we attempt to digest that latest and see what comes of all this. Let's have another one from Peggy Seeger here. I like her.
Hush now, little baby, Sandman's drawing near. Nobody's gonna harm you, Dad will be right here. And Daddy's got a 38, he's got an M16. He's got a 12-gauge shotgun and a Thompson submachine. A Magnum and a Mauser and a stash of TNT. Nobody's gonna harm you. Hush now, go to sleep. That's Bob Boston.
And that's a deterrent lullaby. Regarding Darlene's account, I was having some trouble, as you can hear, getting the specifics. You know, I wanted to see if she could identify any of the people who actually were, she saw in the first incident, actually assaulting, and in the second instance, standing by or coming up to her car or whatever was going on. And I couldn't really, it was kind of hard to slow down her rapid narrative, so I don't know. This is Free Speech Radio. I tend to give people some latitude, although I want to find out what's going on. I'm a little concerned about simply characterizing people, the group of individuals who she's concerned about as just as African Americans. Because, and she said, well, if they were Martians, I call them Martians. Well, a lot of people have the same kind of apprehension of African Americans as they might for Martians. That's the problem. It's a form of essentially, it's racism, and it's not something that we're aware of most of the time, but it's there. And I'm not saying that there are all kinds of people who can thug you, right, left, center, black, white, brown, yellow, you know, you name it. And the question is, who were they? What did they actually do? Was it the same group? And these are questions that I couldn't, in that particular short period of time, get satisfactory answers to. So I'm kind of stuck with that. I'm going to hear a little bit more about, we're going to play a little more about the Board of Supervisors, and I'm going to go into Uncle Dennis's show, because I don't think Uncle Dennis is in town. I think he's still meandering around out in the wilderness somewhere. We're going to be playing you some, again, dusty old show that, hopefully you'll enjoy anyway. And there is a parade for the Santa Cruz 11 coming up on Friday, tomorrow, and it's going to be at 4 o'clock. The echo you hear in the room is Dr. Michael O'Grady muttering everything I say after I say it. You can always mutter, you can sing, you can speak, you can come up to the mic if you want to say something. Michael often sneaks into the end of the show and often has some interesting reports, sometimes he infuriates me with his muttering. But that's just me. I've got these problems, you know. In any case, so there's going to be a 4 o'clock march on behalf of the Santa Cruz 11 in the parking lot behind the Saturn Cafe right across from the Sub Rosa on Pacific Avenue. Wear colorful costumes. You can probably find it mentioned on the Indie Bay website, Santa Cruz Indie Media. And that's 4 o'clock. And you can even wear a Bob Lee mask. We can have some Bob Lee masks. It's going to be, I don't know if it's going to be a beg-in for Bob Lee, so we can help get the boodle for his gang over there at the Wells Fargo Bank. And I know, that sounds a little prejudicial, but the fact of the matter is Lee's got the whole resources of the county arrayed against poor individuals who are simply asserting their right to protest, and frankly, they're protesting about a large corporate bankster. And that, to me, when Lee, you know, puts himself in that position, well, then that's the position he puts himself in. Let's hear some more from the Board of Stoops.
We're here. Is there anybody else that would like to address us? Good morning, Mr. Norris. Welcome.
Good morning to the community and to the Board of Supervisors. The right to sleep without being awakened at midnight and told to move on, it's a kind of torture when you are. It's also a form of terror. It treats the homeless as pariahs and pests. Its message is made more explicit by groups like Take Back Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Neighbors, Take Back Aptos. You're not human beings. You're not worthy of the protection of the Constitution. You're not even worthy of being listened to with any attention at this board, as I see one of our members is not doing, looking at Mr. Coonerty. It is also the message of the Santa Cruz Sheriff who harass homeless people in their vehicles or on the ground. This is a wave of terror that you fund, endorse, and support through your silence. In Ferguson, Missouri, the community is in open rebellion. Faced with racist curfews, move-along attacks on peaceful protests, rationalized police murder, and repression through armored personnel vehicles, tear gas, and snarling dogs. We've seen this on TV nightly. White supremacists terrorizing the 70% black majority. And the righteous response is the cry of outrage and courage. Don't shoot! Something like Richard Quigley used to do here when confronted by abusive sheriffs. Ferguson is the scene of a community rising up in outrage. It is the oppressed making the demand to be treated like human beings. Such demands don't mean spit in chambers like these. But made on the streets, they can suddenly be heard. People start to understand that they are not alone, that they are not criminals. How much military equipment are our deputies using? What kind of arrangements do they have to suppress protests, as they did with the Occupy movement, right outside this building, where it is still illegal to sit at 6:01 in the evening with a sign? Illegal. That's trespass. You in power are the criminal enablers if you watch these steps toward tyranny and do nothing. Is Santa Cruz so very different than Ferguson? I think not. Tomorrow at 10 a.m., Linda LeMaster, an elderly mother of three, faces jail under your anti-poor laws, the same code that Becky Johnson was talking about, the so-called anti-lodging law, where lodging means remaining in an area that armed and uniformed gunmen, the sheriffs, funded by you, don't want you. 10 a.m., Superior Court. Tomorrow at 8:15 in Department 6, the master of foreclosure fraud, the Wells Fargo Bank, will be forced to cough up documents. Documents that show the $34,000 loan to your DA, Bob Lee. That's Bob Lee, the smooth, smiling, glad-handing Bob Lee, who got the power with a $34,000 election eve loan from the same Wells Fargo, then declined to disclose it before he began prosecuting those from whom he wants restitution money. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. Is there anybody else who'd like to address this during oral communications? Please feel free to step forward. Morning, Ms. Garrett. Welcome.
Good morning, and thanks to the three previous speakers, and I think I think it's important to follow the direction they're calling you to do, because this is a human rights issue, the right to sleep and not be terrorized when you sleep. It's also a human right to have a safe environment. And I have a quote here from a June meeting of John Leopold, where he said, environmental health is critical to the overall health of our community. May have been speaking of prohibiting fracking at that time. Also, environmental health has to do with this exposure to radio frequency, microwave radiation, cell towers, distributed antenna systems, Wi-Fi, like you have throughout this building. The recent decision in Saskatchewan.
And that's Marilyn Garrett at the Board of Supervisors. Marilyn speaks with a quavering voice, but what she talks about is an important issue and one which a lot of us choose to ignore for the purposes of convenience. Cell phones are convenient. Microwave towers are convenient until, you know, years later when you learn what kind of a negative impact they may have had. I myself, don't have a cell phone, but I'm there are smart meters in where I live. I've encouraged the landlord not to do that, but it hasn't been a major issue for me in the way it has been for others, and I've had people on the program talking about those issues. Indeed, at this particular hearing, Marilyn Garrett's caretaker or friend was with her, Angela, and she candidly talked to me about how she can actually be aware of the impact of these microwaves on her. And it was a major issue a couple years ago. In fact, the Board of Supervisors passed a resolution requiring, stopping the installation of smart meters, but that they didn't stop them. And sheriffs instead went out and arrested the protesters. Anyway, I also got because I'm running out of time here, so I'm just going to go quickly to this latest update from Leanna, who's a homeless activist who faced loss of her vehicle, loss of her pet, loss of her driver's license because she was in a car with a bottle of booze waiting for Sunrise Cafe, which is sort of the name for the warming center out at the Circles Church 3 days a week to open up at 4 o'clock in the morning. A highway patrol vehicle, according to her account, came by, although what a highway patrol vehicle is doing patrolling Santa Cruz at 4 in the morning is a good question, and demanded that she take a breathalyzer test, which she apparently failed, but she was in no way, by her account, drunk, but she simply was not, and she was not driving. She was waiting for the warming center to open up. She was able to get back her vehicle, but not her driver's license. She's struggling to deal with that. But she did send me an email of some note that notes that the Santa Cruz Public Works Department has posted notices on the inside perimeter of Arrett Circle. That's where she was harassed in her vehicle by the highway patrol. Arrested, actually. It's right near the Circle Church at 111 Arrett Circle. And these notices state that the Public Works will be instituting a residential permit parking, putting up essentially no parking between midnight and 5 a.m. signs that will essentially make it more difficult for people to park their vehicles to go to the Sunrise Room and the Sunrise Cafe at the Circles Church at 4 a.m. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. And there's a letter you can write to. You can write a letter, an address you can write to the Santa Cruz Public Works Department at 809 Center Street. Attention, Tish Barino, if you want to oppose this. That's something you can do. You can also send an email to